Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Our lives have never been more under a microscope, have they? Living in a multicultural, multi-faith society adds a breadth to our understanding, for sure. But what happens to our understanding of what is right and wrong in the face of so many different perspectives? Are there absolute right and wrongs? Today we have the second of a three-part Open House mini-series on ethics with the lecturer in ethics at Moore College and the director of the college's Centre for Christian Living, the Reverend Dr. Andrew Cameron. In his book A Joined Up Life, A Christian Account of How Ethics Works, Andrew sees ethics as the whole of Christian theology, living life practically. Andrew, thanks once again for joining us on Open House. Let's kick off with what would appear to be a pretty obvious premise. Surely drunkenness and rage is always wrong.
Yes, well, thanks for having me, Dwayne. It's a great one to jump in on. The section of the book that this little chapter introduces is kind of a grab bag, different things that are important to consider when we think about ethics. And I wanted to begin with something that, of course, I guess on the face of it, most, you know, many people would hear those words and go, Of course, we shouldn't get blind drunk.
Yeah.
Of course, we shouldn't, you know, have fits of rage. But the problem is, actually, people do, don't they? And indeed, not only do they do those things, they feel pretty right about doing them in the moment. So the example I used from my own life was when I was a fair bit younger. I had a fairly rocky relationship with my father, as a lot of young blokes do, and I got into the habit of just getting, some pretty serious temper tantrums, which I think I'd kind of picked up from him a little bit. And then I got married in my early 20s, and I used to do this in my marriage, you know. And my wife would say to me, "Look, I don't like that, and I don't think you should do it." And my response, as I think I still hear a lot of people do today, was, "Well, you know, sorry, honey, you knew what you were signing up for. This is just me.
Yeah.
You know? This is my identity.
Yeah.
Just, you know, deal with it." And I just had this really powerful sense of this is who I am. This is what I'm about in the world, and don't you mess with me, you know. And so what is that? You know, what's going on for us when we're so completely assured of our own kind of rightness in some, you know, area of our lives that, you know, other people look at and go, you know, that's terrible. It's a really strange thing. We're kind of a self-justifying species, you know. We just do this, you know. We just can get into this, elsewhere in the book I call it a gestalt, you know, sort of a way of seeing things that you just can't budge, you know. And what happened for me was, as a Christian at the time, and I'd, you know, sort of read my Bible, you know, on occasion, as you do, and this phrase leapt out to me in Paul's letter to the Galatians, that one of the, what he calls the so-called fruits of the flesh, is fits of rage, you know. And it just hit me like a freight train that this was me, you know. Mm. I just had these fits of rage, and so this was the first dawning awareness for me that there was something terribly wrong, you know. And
so if ethics, Andrew, are a grayscale continuum, and at one end we have rage and the other end we have anger, for instance, where is the divining line between appropriate and inappropriate behavior? If you look at Jesus Christ, he showed anger on more than one occasion.
Yeah, that's right. And this is why, as I think I said to you last time, this is why I believe that outside of the heat of really high-stakes moments, we have to do the task of reflection and deliberation about what matters, you know. And clearly, even anger is something that, you know, God has embedded into our nature that has a purpose. You know, anger defends what matters. You know, that's the, you know, when we're kind of angry on behalf of a weak person who's being victimized or at some neglect that others are doing. I mean, this is a very good thing, you know. It's our spirit kind of rising up to defend what matters. But of course, the problem is that when I just think that I'm the one that matters most, that's what I'm getting angry about, you know. So we've got to actually, as it were, interrogate our anger and its reasons. And actually, really interestingly, what you've then got to interrogate is what you love the most. You see, because you'll get angry about what you love the most, and it might turn out that some of the things that you love gone a bit out of proportion, you know. And that was true in my life. I was getting angry and defensive about things that, you know, mattered to me, but I was not loving, you know, things that really mattered to others, you know. And so my kind of anger was the kind of anger that wasn't defensible because it was just in service of myself all the time.
Yeah. You know? So the answer to what do you love the most may end up being yourself, in which case you've got a problem.
That's right. I mean, yeah. to a degree, you know, we all, you know, this is the problem of being human. We all have legitimate things that we have to, you know, kind of look after on our own behalf, but they get blown out of all proportion, you know. We just forget that we're embedded in this matrix of relationships. We've got to care for others and care for, you know, the needs of the next generation and stuff like that, you know. So it's all about being called out of that immediate sort of obvious love for yourself, which is what I think the Bible means by flesh. And that's why Paul calls these fits of rage fruit of the flesh. You know, the flesh is nothing wrong with being, you know, a body, but what we do is we act like our little bodies are all that matters, you know, and we act in defence of our own little embodied existence to the exclusion of all else.
Freedom. It's such a dynamic and explosive word. And when it comes to ethics, is there ever a case for total freedom in our lives?
Yeah, I think freedom is a kind of an overused and even abused word, because it's come to mean the freedom to, as it were, affect whatever thought pops into my head, as long as it, you know, the only stricture we have in our society is as long as it doesn't hurt someone else, you know. Now, that kind of works. You can sort of muddle along as a society on that basis, and we have done, you know, but are we actually truly free just to enact whatever thought pops into our head? And it seems to me that the biblical authors press back on that and say, no, you're only free when you know what you're for.
Yeah.
You're only free when you know your kind of purpose in life, you know.
Yeah.
And to simply indulge every impulse doesn't necessarily mean that you're finding, you know, you're acting in a way that is in accordance with your true purpose. So what am I hinting at with purpose? Well, at very least, you know, when Jesus says love God with all you've got and love your neighbour as yourself, that's a bit of a statement of purpose, that's the kind of beings we are, you know. We're people who are called to these relationships of love, you know. So we're truly free, oddly, when we sometimes say no to things that are against our purpose.
My girls came home from church a couple of weeks back. One of them had a sticker, and on it was, "What would Jesus do?"
Mm.
The first thing the girls said when they faced a problem in their home life was, "What would Jesus do?" And they looked at me as if to say, "I don't know. He doesn't have PlayStation."
Exactly. And, you know, he wasn't a married person, and he didn't have children, you know. So this is the sort of surface problem with that saying, because Jesus, in order to be the Son of God come in human form, he had to be a particular person. He had to be a particular human being in a particular time and place, which means that there's lots about his immediate world that's going to be very different for every other Christian believer since, you know. So there's lots of things that you can't immediately generalise. You can't be a carpenter. Carpenters can be a carpenter, but not all of us can. Mm. You know, things like that. Yet, at the same time, they do in Scripture, you know, point to Jesus as an example, and it is a pretty obvious thing for a Christian believer to do, to ponder what Jesus might do in their situation. So I think the best way to put this together is to say that we're called to discover how to, as it were, sort of inhabit Jesus' character. What were his settled habits and patterns of action and feeling? What did he love constantly? What mattered to him most? You know, and to learn our way into these things in our own lives is possible, even though our particularities of our lives are different.
Obedience to God. The question, should we be obedient without question?
Mm.
Your answer to that is?
Yes and no. I had to tell the story in this chapter. This is a little bit of a personal one. I had
yes.
to go back to that that matter I mentioned earlier with my dad.
Because yes.
I've grown to the point where I deeply love my dad, well, the memory of him, and can see what he was about in the world. But he had the kind of troubles in his life that meant He often didn't know how to solve problems when he was raising his family other than just yelling a command, you know, and expecting it to be obeyed, and there was trouble if you didn't, you know?
Yeah.
And this kind of made me, this put me in a pretty negative place about the notion of obedience in the Bible. It just felt like a cop-out. It just felt like the biblical authors were saying, just, you know, shut up and do what you're told and don't think about it. Now, nothing could be further from the truth, actually. They're not into don't think about it. They think of obedience to God's commands as a kind of a mixture between, as it were, a red light to stop you in the moment when you're going to do something that you don't know the full story about, that you need to just not do. But they also think of it as God's loving, fatherly instruction to teach us how to be different and who to be different and how his world works, you know. So obedience in the Bible is very thoughtful, you know. It stops us in the moment, but then we're invited and called into all of the reasoning behind behind the you know, various commands that undergirds. And the other point to note is that the Bible is actually very nuanced about which commands are for which people. So it doesn't follow that if you read something in the Old Testament law that one is necessarily expected to obey it after Jesus has come. You know, so there's a little bit of complexity in working out which is a command for us. But they're all good and helpful and interesting because they induct us into seeing how the world works.
Our last question for this get-together, Andrew, revolves around the relevance of the church. So what is the ethical role of the church? Is it to provide a space to grow together, or is it a place to set believers apart?
Yeah, that's really well put. I think this is such an important question that it really actually needed three chapters in my book that are sort of scattered throughout. And the first one simply observes that in the pages of the New Testament, when church is relatively unformed, it has to be said, they're still nutting out what to do together. But the emphasis in the Bible isn't so much on the the formalities of it, but on how are we going to get on as a community, the things that come out of this. This being with these other people become our training ground for learning again how to care for one another. And so Christianity is a deeply communal religion. When we come together, we learn what it is to love again, to love properly. Right? So it's not just an individualist thing. And that's the grand vision of church. But of course, the reality is because you've got broken, messed up people coming together, the practice of it is often extremely difficult and disappointing, yeah. You know. So we're in this really amazing experiment, really, which is how do you find what it is to relate as a community of people who love and care and respect each other well, even though we're all like patients in a hospital, as it were, who are incredibly bad at this. You know, so there's times when I find church, I list all the churches that I've had a part of somewhere in the book, and I've found some of them better than others, and sometimes I find the experience really arduous, but I don't give up on it because it seems to me that it's one of God's key methods for showing me how to be different by helping me do this with other people.
Andrew Cameron, we're going to hit pause here for a moment, and when next we catch up, we're going to put the rubber on the road and we're going to discuss marriage, work, homosexuality and bioethics. Are you up for this?
I'll give it a go, Dwayne. Thank you.